This is a good agreement. It is a historic agreement. It gets to lower class sizes. It gets to proper support staff, to community-based schools, to special ed, adult ed, to expanded green space, and the list goes on.
Eric Garcetti this morning, the mayor, announcing an end to the teachers' strike. Teachers are expected to be back in school tomorrow. Garcetti gave credit to UTLA President Alex Caputo-Pearl and LAUSD Superintendent Austin Buettner.
This would not have been done if they didn't stick to it, and if two folks didn't say it's time for a new day in public education in Los Angeles. That new day begins now. This is not the end. This is the beginning of making sure that LA gets the schools they deserve.
Garcetti says the negotiations ended at 6:15 this morning after 21 hours of talks. A marathon for sure. Howard Bloom is education reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He's here to talk about the agreement. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Also joining us, David Tukofsky, education strategist, former LAUSD teacher and school board member. Hi, David.
Good afternoon.
Howard, the details, they are now on paper. What are the highlights?
Well, the highlights are that the teachers are getting a 6% raise over 2 years, I guess, and it's actually mostly retroactive because they've been negotiating for 2 years. But they've also lost about 3% by going on strike, so at least in the short term, that raise is mitigated against. You could say they took one for the team education. And they're also supposed to be full-time nurses in every school. They're supposed to be librarians in every middle and high school. And there's class size reduction, but it's very modest and gradual. And, oh, there's some more academic counselors in high school. So I guess those are the big things.
All right. It sure seemed that Alex Caputo-Pearl, the head of the union, was happy today after he went to this joint news conference with Austin Buettner, the superintendent, and the mayor. He attended a rally with the teachers.
This district is going to hire 300 more nurses. You did that. This district is going to hire 80 more teacher librarians. You did that. This district is going to finally be held to a 500-to-1 counselor ratio. You did that.
David Tukofsky, is he overselling this agreement?
Well, to me, what sticks out the most is this district rather than saying our district. One would hope that at the end of this, they were moving forward together for the future to get more revenue. Yes, there's no question that the number of members in the UTLA bargaining unit went up quite a bit, and that's good for kids and good for the union as well. I don't think it's historic, like the mayor called it. As a history teacher, I would not put it up there with 1968 or 1848. It's not a historic moment. The question really is open, is what are they going to do in the months and weeks ahead as to getting the revenue that they need to continue these incremental steps?
Howard, the union sure made a very strong stance against taking incremental steps, and they said they were basically going to go on strike until they got what they wanted, and what they wanted was a big change. This doesn't seem like a big change.
I don't think it is in a lot of the main things. Now, it isn't clear how much more money, if any, the district put into its offer. They certainly moved around the pots of money to give the union apparently details that were more to its liking than what the district offered. But, you know, it's hard to see a lot more money in this deal than what the district was offering before the union went on strike. Now, there are some peripheral things that are very important to the union and that add some oomph to this deal. There's going to be investment in what the union calls community schools, 30 schools with wraparound services, social services, supposed to be a rich, robust curriculum with arts in there, and more governing authority for teachers and parents. That's a pilot program. There's a path to doing away with random searches of students, which is something the student supporters of the district wanted. Now, they did get rid of this clause that essentially allows the district to vary from the size of classes, that formula in the contract, whenever the district wants to, just by saying it's a financial necessity. So the union was very happy about that, and that is meaningful, but the class size reductions are very gradual. It's one next year, another one the year after that, two more the year after that. that, and then an additional two at a small number of especially high-need schools. And some of that actually may be conditional, depending on whether a tax increase is approved by voters. So it's not what I would call a total victory, but they did change the conversation a little bit. They got everybody paying attention to public education, and there was a lot of support for teachers. The question is, can those good feelings, if you want to talk about good feelings from a strike, can those continue and be pushed into policy changes?
Hmm. Yeah, so they were all smiles, or at least they looked somewhat satisfied. They looked really tired today at that news conference, but they were all standing together. David, behind the scenes, is there a lot of bad blood still between the union and Austin Buettner?
Well, I don't know how the rhetoric against Austin Buettner will heal. I mean, it was pretty mean, vicious out there. The question will be, how do they set a common agenda? There was not one word mentioned of putting a parcel tax on, which they could have had on this past November, which probably would have passed and averted probably a strike. Neither side was for a parcel tax. Neither side has stood up for a parcel tax, and the charters haven't either. Similarly, there's a board election out there that is going to become polemic in the last weeks and months. If I lined up everything that happened here, there were two very good things, which was exactly what Howard said about the sentiment towards public education and teachers. And two, as a social studies teacher, I think kids from grade K to 12 learned what a strike it was and what solidarity meant and what unity meant far more than they could get out of any textbook or classroom. That was quite impressive. Mm-hmm. Last, most important thing, the real hero this season is Gavin Newsom and the state budget. He put $3 billion into the pension. That's billions of dollars. He put money into special ed, put $2 billion into early ed. So he's really set an optimistic agenda. It would look very silly if the mayor and this school district went to a negative point after the optimism of Gavin's budget.
Right. And so any pledge for all the parties to make sure that the legislature approves Gavin Newsom's budget, that they actually get the money, that they work together to make sure that they get more money from Sacramento?
Exactly. And so that happens between now and May. The tax revenues come in on the April 15th.
But are they going to work together to go do that, to go lobby Sacramento?
There was no word about that. And, and the district went up the day before the governor's budget was announced, which is kind of silly because I'm sure he wrote it a month or so before the day of the budget. So let's hope they can do that. And that they can also ask the state with their reserve to do something about class size reduction at a grand scale.
Also, charters. The union made a big deal of charters, even though this is something that is controlled by the state. They got something, it seems, just reading the headline in this agreement, something slightly to their advantage, but pretty marginal, Howard, about co-location. They get some kind of say. It seems pretty vague when a charter is located on a district school's property.
Well, that's right. There can be like a co-location. I kind of hate that word. A coordinator at a school site, and you know what? They weren't asking that much related to charters in the actual contract negotiations. The rhetoric on charters was really outside the contract negotiations, but they were hoping that the governor or outside parties would make significant steps on charter schools that would play into the negotiations. But they did get a little something in the contract. They weren't asking for as much related to charters in the contract as you might think. And the board is supposed to consider a resolution asking for a moratorium on charters. But that's a very symbolic step. Mm-hmm. The charter law is done at the state level. I mean, it could happen.
Yeah.
Who knows?
And then finally, testing. There is a committee that will develop a plan to reduce the amount of testing by 50%.
Well, we'll see if it's reduced by 50%. But the committee is there, and that allows the union to declare victory on that front. And maybe it would be meaningful in that they would have some input into what the right amount of standardized testing is. But that's certainly something that has traditionally been a district decision because it's something that applies district-wide.
I was going to add two things. One, on the UTLA fact sheet summary, the first item on there is the privatization and charter cap resolution. So it's still a rhetorical top liner for them. It's three categories above salary, but it was a victory for public education. I don't want to minimize that at all. I think UTLA, the teachers with the community and the students and the leadership of UTLA really, I think, surprised everybody about the power of that unity. But now let's see if they can take this energy and look at the June and November elections of 2020. And lastly, the mayor, of all the categories he has with MTA and others, the city did not put, as far as I can see yet, $1. They gave their conference room, and they caused Mr. Buettner to come in, but the mayor did not bring any money to the children.
Oh, I think that remains to be seen. I think the mayor has said he was planning to bring some resources to the table. Just to be fair, we didn't see that today, as David points out, but I would be surprised if we didn't see something. At least the mayor has said he planned to bring some resources to the table as well. So that's what he said. We'll see if it happens.
Okay, politically, how do they look? Does Mayor Garcetti look strong, that he's a leader of the city by bringing these two sides together? And of the other two, which one is going to run for higher office?
Well, it was a necessary win for Garcetti, because if rumors are true and he plans to announce for president, first of all, you can't make that announcement during a teacher's strike. And even though he has no authority over the school district, unlike the mayors in Chicago and New York, for the teachers to go on strike and the school system to fall apart on his watch, that would not be a resume builder in a presidential campaign. So he had to jump in. So it was a matter of civic duty and, if you will, personal necessity in terms of potential political goals. And he kind of pulled it off. I think it's fair to say that Garcetti made the strike shorter than it would have otherwise been, because the parties were just not dealing with each other, and he kind of made them do it. So it's a win for Garcetti, at least in the short term. As far as the others, Austin Buettner, well, now he gets to be superintendent for a while, and let's actually see what he does. And in the short term, it looks like a big win for Alex Caputo-Pearl, because he endured a lot of criticism for taking teachers to strike when, in fact, he knew, or he had to know, that there were limits to the resources in the district budget. And he caused a crisis, and he said it was worth causing a crisis. And a lot of people think he kind of pulled it off. So, you know, in the short term, there may be no losers. It's just a question of what happens from here.
Howard Bloom, education reporter for the Los Angeles Times. David Tikofsky, education strategist. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Yes, happy to do it.
My pleasure to be part of the discussion.
Coming up on the program, our legal eagle, Jessica Levinson, analyzes the Supreme Court's decision allowing President Trump to exclude transgender people from the military. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Supreme Court has sided with President Trump's ban on transgender people serving in the military. Until now, the ban had been on hold after some lower courts blocked it as the challenges worked their way up the system. It is Monday, and that means one thing. Our legal eagle, actually, it's Tuesday, but we're pretending it's Monday. So that means our legal eagle, Jessica Levinson, is here. Hi.
Happy fake Monday.
Exactly. I'm so used to saying it is Monday and you're here, but you're here all the time. All right. So this is worth reiterating that this is not the final say on the actual contents of the ban, right? This is a procedural motion.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the Supreme Court today did not say, President Trump, when you want to ban transgender people from serving in the military, that's no problem. What they said is that they're basically undoing lower court decisions. And those lower court decisions said the transgender military ban doesn't get to go into effect while we're hearing the cases. And so really all we know today is that the ban does in fact get to go into effect, with some exceptions, but we don't know ultimately whether or not the Supreme Court will find that this is a constitutional exercise.
Did they give any hints that it might be, that how they might rule on the contents of it, on the merits?
Well, the hint is basically in the decision itself. So it was a 5-4 decision with our classic kind of conservative to liberal breakdown. And the hint is, if they really thought the transgender military ban was such a problem, then why would they allow it to go into effect at all? Why wouldn't they just keep the status quo? Because the status quo is transgender people get to continue to serve. And so the question kind of is, well, why would you take this action if you thought the law was really okay and constitutional? I think one explanation is that in this case and other cases, what the lower courts, and by that I mean the trial courts, have done is they've said, we're prohibiting this ban. We're basically banning the ban, not just for our particular jurisdiction, like not just for Southern California, but for the entire nation. And so there's a kind of new legal development of nationwide injunctions. And one possible explanation is that the Supreme Court took its action today because it just doesn't like these nationwide injunctions. I think the more likely explanation is they don't have a huge problem with the ban.
So what does that mean practically for the 900 or so people who are transgender and are currently serving in the military?
Yeah, so what it means is that the ban is allowed to go into effect with the kind of policy exceptions that the administration later, kind of after the tweet announcing the ban, had had laid out. So those exceptions are if you already were serving and or if you do not want gender reassignment therapy. For that 900, they're basically grandfathered in and they can continue serving. So the question is kind of what do we do going forward with a much larger group of people and or the people who say, no, I do want gender reassignment. And for them, they are covered by the ban.
And for people who want to join the military.
Exactly. Exactly.
OK, so let's look at another case. On Friday, the court dropped a case that deals with whether the Trump administration can add a question about citizenship to the 2020 census. Why did the court drop that case?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting question because the court case didn't actually deal with whether or not the Trump administration can add a question about citizenship, even though everyone called it the census citizenship question. So the question that the Supreme Court was going to hear is in the trial dealing with whether or not you can put a citizenship question in the census, can you ask certain federal officials to be deposed because you want to hear their real motivation for why they included that question, and you want to go beyond the administrative record. So that was the narrow question that the court had set for February 19th. It wasn't whether or not you can ask about citizenship. It was basically, can you ask a federal official about why they included the question? And in the interim, what happened is the trial in that case continued. The trial court judge said, you know what, you cannot include citizenship as a question on the census. It would lead to a massive undercount. The court said, you have created a smorgasbord of federal law violations. And so what the challengers to the census said is, you know what, we still think you should be able to depose federal officials. But our question is basically moot because we won even without their deposition. So Supreme Court, if you want to hear this question, hear the big question. And that's basically what the Supreme Court agreed to. So they may still hear the big question, but they're not going to hear that kind of small question about who can you depose.
Okay. And then in reaction to that, the Trump administration today asked the court to fast track that, the legal process, to hear the merits of this case. How likely do you think the justices are to do that?
I actually think pretty likely because the census has to be printed by the end of June. And so typically what would happen is we have this ruling in the trial court. The trial court says you don't get to ask about citizenship, and then you would appeal it to the Court of Appeals. With this exception, you can go straight to the Supreme Court if basically you have to because there's such a pressing time issue. And that's what's happened today. So I think that the Supreme Court docket is basically set for 2018-2019 with the caveat that I think there's a good chance that they end up basically having to hear this census question.
And I guess, can you glean from past statements or rulings on similar cases or anything related how they might rule on this? I know this is really parsing very thick tea leaves, but
no,
whatever.
Well, so no, I mean, I think it's a really, you know, it's a really good and fair question. I mean, it's a somewhat different Supreme Court than the court that we had, for instance, when they may have looked at similar cases. I think what's interesting here is the court said that the trial could continue. So they didn't block the trial court from saying, you get to hear this case while the Supreme Court heard that fairly narrow issue of, can you depose a federal official? And so the fact that they let that play out in the lower court, that might be some indication of their comfort, but, you know, I'm not sure. What they have is a pretty developed record, and what they have is a district court saying, like, basically, let me count the ways that you violated federal law, and saying, Trump administration, we don't agree with you. Your reason for needing this was you said that we have to accurately count citizens in order to try and uphold voting rights laws. And ultimately, that really just hasn't been found with any favor by lower court judges. They frankly just don't believe that.
Mm. Right. And then there was that confusion as to where this directive came from in the first place. Did it come from Justice or did it come from Wilbur Ross? And there were some disputes over the accuracy of some statements regarding that.
Exactly. And that's why they wanted to depose Wilbur Ross in that trial, because mm-hmm. they wanted to say, well, who did this come from? You said it came from the Department of Justice. Now it looks like maybe it didn't come from the Department of Justice. And I think challengers, frankly, are fairly happy today because they didn't even need to ask Wilbur Ross questions about where did the question originate? You know, why did you want the question on there in order to win? Having said that, I believe that the judge was appointed by President Obama. And if we do kind of now live in a world where the president who appointed you dictates outcomes, that doesn't necessarily mean victory in the Supreme Court.
Okay, finally, let's talk DACA, because Trump has now offered a deal on DACA in exchange for opening up the government. And it doesn't look like the Democrats will go for it. But how could the court play into this? Because they do have a case before them which would protect the Dreamers.
Yes. So this is really interesting just politically, in the sense that what President Trump did is tried to repeal the program DACA, and then he was blocked. Basically, every lower court who has looked at whether or not the Trump administration could end DACA has said either you can't or you can't in the way that you tried to, for a variety of procedural reasons. And the Supreme Court, it looks like this term will not hear the case, meaning those lower court decisions that said, President Trump, you don't get to end DACA, that's the law of the land for probably at least another year. So when President Trump says, I'll protect Dreamers for three more years, in fact, they were already legally protected probably for at least a year.
So he could amend that and say two more years, be accurate.
He could amend that and say two more years. And this, of course, assumes that if the Supreme Court decides to hear it next term, they hear it right away, and they say, President Trump, you can do that. You can. So it's not clear that he's really offering anything. He may be legally prohibited from ending DACA at least this way anyway.
Jessica, great to talk to you on a Tuesday, on a Monday, on any day of the week. Thank you.
If we talk, it's a good Tuesday.
Okay, great. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. By the way, the RBG documentary was nominated for an Oscar this morning. Coming up, we're going to talk about some of the Oscar nominations, including the Oscar snubs. We'll find out who did not get a nomination.
Maybe the Academy is having a hard time making the move into a world where films that are actually successful at the box office are actually also successful with their voters. But clearly, Crazy Rich Asians touch much more than a nerve, and yet nothing.
That conversation ahead on Press Play. The This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Even without a host, the Academy Awards will go on. And bright and early this morning, the nominations were announced. Netflix made history by snagging 10 nominations for Alfonso Cuarón's Roma. It's tied with The Favorite for most nominations this year. And some snubs, Ryan Coogler, Barry Jenkins, Bradley Cooper, not listed for Best Director, a category that, once again, unsurprisingly, includes no women. Dominic Patton is here to tell us more. He's senior editor at Deadline. Hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great, thanks. Well, let's start with the big winners, Roma and The Favorite, nominated for Best Picture. And is that surprising?
Not really. I mean, they've got 10 nominations apiece. And this Netflix film and this Fox film are really going in strong. I mean, look, Netflix made some history today. Best Picture nomination. It's amazing to think of Netflix, and we talk about it so much now, Netflix and chill, obviously, is that famous expression, et cetera, et cetera. They didn't even have any original programming 6 years ago.
Amazing.
Like, it's crazy. It's crazy.
Right.
Now they're nominated for Oscars.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also nominated for Best Foreign Language Film.
Yeah.
Could it win both?
It would be historic, and it would be... I guess, you know, I'm just going to stick with historic. You know,
okay.
It's funny. People overuse that phrase all the time.
Yeah.
In an unprecedented historic event, like, isn't that the same thing? But I have to say, I think things are leaning more towards the Best Picture. Honestly, I think that it's just it's a strong race, and they're well deep in it.
And then if he wins Best Director, that would be the second year in a row a Mexican director has won.
Yeah, it'd be fantastic. It'd be fantastic. And, I think that says a lot about where the industry is in terms of the films we're making, the films that we're watching, and the films that we're celebrating. I think, however, there might be, yet again, a bit of a disconnect. Roma's going to be an interesting case. You know, for many, many years, in the past decades or so, a lot of the films that win Best Picture are not necessarily that well seen by people. But I think Roma's probably a pretty well-seen film, even though it is a film that is in Spanish, even though it is a film that is set in Mexico City, even though it's a film that's set in the past, I think it's going to translate.
And Yalitza Aparicio's nomination, she's the second Mexican Best Actress nominee. What do you make of the nominations for Best Actor and Best Actress?
Well, I think they're pretty much what we would have expected in many ways. I mean, I think, look, you look at things like Glenn Close, Olivia Colman for The Favorite, Lady Gaga for A Star is Born, Melissa McCarthy, and, of course, the lady from Roma that you just mentioned. You look at Christian Bale for Vice. You look at Bradley Cooper for A Star is Born, though huge snub that the man himself was not nominated for director for A Star is Born when basically everything else the film was up for was. Willem Dafoe was a surprise. I think that was a surprise for a lot of people.
For At Eternity's Gate, which...
Yeah, I think a lot of people thought Ethan Hawke for First Reformed was going to be the one there for
in the indie slot.
Yeah, and also just, look, Ethan's been around. This is a stellar role for him, and it really dug deep and I think really translated well with a lot of people. Rami Malek for Bohemian Rhapsody as Freddie Mercury, kind of a no-brainer. Same thing with Viggo Mortensen for Green Book. You know, this film is one that really, it had Academy written all over it.
Okay, snubs, notable snubs.
Well, I mean, we mentioned Bradley Cooper. That one's just unbelievable. But I also would say, I think Timothy Chalamet was a distinct snub. His role as a drug-addicted young man in Beautiful Boy has been widely acclaimed and was widely tipped, actually. Certainly he came off some great roles in the past year anyways. This was just completely overlooked. Ryan Coogler didn't get a nod for Black Panther. But I have to say, we've talked about, I think you mentioned Barry Jenkins. I think The Rider was a great film that got overlooked. But I'll tell you the one that just I can't get past, which is Morgan Neville's documentary about Mr. Rogers, Won't You Be My Neighbor. I don't understand.
Not nominated for Best Documentary.
I don't understand that at all. This was, Morgan Neville's a past Oscar winner, so the Academy knows him and knows his work. He's both a populist and a very, very insightful documentary filmmaker in a golden age of documentary, and made a film. I remember him telling me about this film over 3 years ago at the Sundance Film Festival, saying, I'm making a film about Mr. Rogers. And I was like, what? What? And he's like, you don't know. People don't know Mr. Rogers. They think they know him, but they don't know the depth underneath. And when you see that film, just when you see the scene when he has the show that deals with the assassination of Robert Kennedy, when you see him before the Senate committees getting funding for PBS and literally turning it around in real time, this is a remarkable man, one who generations of Americans connect with, and a remarkable film that was a box office success in documentary scale, has been seen by many, won a ton of awards, and got nothing.
I know. And it did seem to just touch a nerve. Everyone loved it and saw it and cried because it seemed to be an antidote to our very fractious times.
And so timely. Now, I would also say another documentary that really surprised me, not to pound the documentary drum too hard, but was Three Identical Strangers, which
is also snubbed.
And an unbelievable story of, without giving too much away, three brothers who didn't know they were brothers, to put it mildly, and the title kind of gives you that. Remarkable it wasn't done. Also, Emily Blunt. Nothing for A Quiet Place, and nothing for Mary Poppins Returns, which was quite surprising. Real crowd pleaser. I would also say another one that I really noticed the absence of in Best Picture was Crazy Rich Asians, which is, again, you know, maybe the Academy is having a hard time making the move into a world where films that are actually successful at the box office are actually also successful with their voters. But clearly, Crazy Rich Asians touched much more than a nerve, to use your phrase. It touched people's hearts. It touched people's funny bones. It touched them in so many different ways. And it was representation made real and made and writ large. And yet, nothing.
Well, there will be no host, speaking of snubs. So what do you make of that? How do you think that's going to play out?
Well, I mean, look, I think they found themselves in a real pickle, to use a Mr. Rogers-type term, with Kevin Hart and his past comments about gay men and his feelings about them and his seemingly inability to kind of come forward and say, I'm sorry, I've learned, I've evolved, and this was wrong. Instead, he was defensive, and then this weird thing with Ellen DeGeneres saying he still should have it and shouldn't have it. I mean, the whole thing just became a mess. I guess they're going to do what they have done in the past. We're very used to, with the Oscars in the past few decades, there's a host. They come out. They do a routine. But actually, for many, many years, there wasn't really a host. Two presenters would come out together. They would do a series of things. So I think that they're going to try to play around this. I got to tell you, it might not be a bad idea by default. Their ratings, while strong, have been falling and falling to record lows year after year for the past few years. So maybe instead of having a Hollywood actor reading lines written for him or her by a million of the same writers who write everything we ever hear before, or Jimmy Kimmel come out and do his shtick, which he does every night and he does very well, but also translates over. I think that this might be a way for them to maybe cut the ratings Gordian knot, or not. And that's how you pun your way out.
Over and out for you.
Thank you, madame.
All done. Dominic Patton, senior editor at Deadline, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Netflix show starring a Japanese woman teaching American families how to organize their stuff has really struck a chord. Why we've all condoized. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so that means it's time for our TV segment we call TV on the Radio.
No one told you that was...
This is serious.
Gumby, no wonder.
There are four bits. The actual retail price is...
You know, a confession. We really, really tried hard not to talk about Marie Kondo on the show, but we just couldn't resist. It seems like the entire country has been condoized. So here we are, too. We're going to talk about the Netflix show. It's called Tidying Up with Marie Kondo. The concept, if you have been living under a disorganized rock, is that she, Marie Kondo, goes to a household every week and teaches her method of tidying up. And as expected from reality TV, she changes the family's lives for the better, perhaps forever, who knows. Here to discuss the show, we have Han Wen. She is senior editor at IndieWire. Hi.
Hi.
And Nicole Clark, culture writer for Vice. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, Han, let's start with you. You're a fan. In fact, your Twitter handle has been condoized.
You know how you do with Twitter for seasonal things, so it's now the Han Mari method.
Okay, why do you like this show?
It's actually very appealing. I think it kind of falls into the whole Japanese nice. We talked about this with Terrace House. She is the ultimate in nice. She comes in, she's smiling, she's neat, she's very polite. And then when she fixes your home and makes your life better, like, what better can you do than that?
So, I know, it seems so easy. All you have to do is learn how to fold, and paradise is yours.
It also reminds me a lot of the Netflix shows that are popular right now, things like Queer Eye, even The Great British Bake Off that's finally come to the U.S., to Netflix. And it's that perfect kind of calming TV show that you put on perhaps in the background or even when you're having a bad day. And you know there's some kind of pleasant resolution and mm-hmm. maybe even a facet of self-improvement that you can get out of it.
Right. Not yourself, perhaps, but you get to enjoy
that. I
feel
like I osmose it a little bit when I watch.
It's also a very good visual medium. You can read the book. You can even look at the other books that have like the folding method in it. But until you see her stand up a t-shirt that's been properly folded, you don't get that satisfaction.
You don't like the skies don't clear, the angels don't sing.
Yeah, it's very satisfying to see. And then how it, you know, everything lines up. She does talk about like sort of having a harmony once you put things together. That's where kind of the joy comes in. Mm. So I was like, yeah, I can kind of see it. Like,
and you
visually.
Interviewed her, right? She speaks only Japanese.
She has a little bit of English, limited English, but she speaks through her interpreter who you saw on the show, Marie Ida. And she's just a wonderfully, very straightforward, very honest person about exactly what she knows, which is tidying.
What does she say about this worldwide phenomenon she has spawned? Is she bowled over by it?
She's super humble, and every time I try to bring up anything about like reputation or fame or what do you think, she almost always goes back to the methods. And just like, the thing is, it's like people feel satisfied. It's the method that's therapeutic, not her.
There's got to be something deeper here about why this is caught on so much, why it resonates so much with so many people right at this moment.
Well, I feel like a lot of people have suffered from excessive clutter. I feel like it's a very American thing to accumulate lots and lots of items, right? Like retail therapy, that's something that we've been taught from a very young age. And I feel like Marie Kondo's method really taps into that, but a lot of people have made this big fuss about it must spark joy. You know, she makes that ching noise, which I find really delightful.
Okay, so for people who don't know what that is, can you explain?
Yeah, when it comes to clutter, she says one of the ways you can try to figure out what to keep is to hold an object in your hands. The sensation is very important, she says. And then if it somehow sparks joy, you get that feeling, then you keep it. Because that way you can keep sentimental items. You can keep things that people say aren't necessarily useful.
But you do still have to have the useful stuff
yes,
that doesn't spark joy.
I think that's been a misconception for a lot of things. People are like, well, what about just plain utility things? These galoshes don't bring me joy. And so she always has to kind of almost explain, like, they bring value to your life, and overall your life is more joyful for having dry feet. Also, if you actually, I forgot the actual Japanese word she uses for it, but doesn't translate exactly to spark joy. Mm. It's like palpitate or throb. So it's more of like, if it stirs an emotion or sensation in you, so it could be something perturbing that you absolutely love, like this murder novel, you know, and it could... That could be joy in a way.
Well, speaking of novels, there's been some controversy right over the books.
Yeah.
People are saying she's telling us to throw out all our books. What?
Well, it came from, I think, a few different things. One was that, you know, people don't like to be told what to do. And so on the show, she actually is helping someone get rid of certain books and saying that you need to, you know, pick the ones that have an immediate value in your life right now. A lot of people who are book lovers don't see that. Some of them are research things. Some of them are like sentimental value. But I think there's been a little bit of backlash, and that's come from many things like, A, don't tell us what to do, Gillette ad.
We've already done that segment.
Yeah.
We're going to move on from that.
Yeah, don't tell us what to do. But also, you know, like Americans love their stuff. Mm. And then I think also books do have a special place in people's hearts, especially people love
books.
Just
the idea of throwing away books.
Yeah, this is Fahrenheit 451. You don't want to go there.
Exactly.
Oh, I also think that sparking joy is kind of a shorthand to help people understand how to approach clutter. I feel like a lot of Americans are intimidated by it because they see it as, let me select what I no longer want. And then you feel like this kind of offensive, deeply held, you know, this is a sentimental item.
And
how
you're
could
rejecting
I possibly
something
get rid of
that
it?
Was once a part of
exactly.
me.
Right. But when you look at a whole pile of things and you think to yourself, these are the things I love, suddenly that huge task becomes much more easy to palate because you're looking at all of your items and you're picking out the things that bring you joy rather than looking at things and assuming you have to find, you know, the bad thing that you want to get rid of.
Now, you are looking at the show, Nicole, through a feminist lens, and you're seeing what it reveals in terms of how we organize ourselves in our households, how work is gendered, how even the show itself is gendered, who's watching it, we're three women talking about it. It just seems like it's...
That didn't escape me. Yeah.
Yeah. So what conclusions have you come to?
Well, first, I don't think that Marie Kondo herself necessarily posits this as a feminist idea. I think what we come across in the show is probably a bit inadvertent, but so many household tasks and chores in general are quite gendered. With women taking on more of the chores, there's this French comic artist named Emma who's published with The Guardian. She wrote about this phenomenon called the mental load, which you can think of as a cognitive task of project management in the house. So it's not just doing the chores, it's remembering which chores need to get done. So the person who remembers how much toilet paper you have left, right? And that's work in itself, to constantly remember that.
And then remembers to schedule the dental appointments for the kids.
Exactly.
Remembers to take the dog out and, oh, by the way, buy dog food because we ran out last night, etc.
Yeah. And this comic Emma says, doing the chores themselves, perhaps you split that 50-50, right? However, project management in the professional world is a completely separate job. So if you think about women taking on the majority of that project management, well, women are doing two jobs in the household. And we rarely get to see this on screen. And the show, Tidying Up with Marie Kondo, taking us into homes and her process where each person is forced to tidy, or forced is quite a forceful word, but is asked to tidy their own possessions first, really throws into high relief. I recall one of these episodes, the Mercier family, I believe. The husband begins the episode by saying, you know, my wife helps me find this special shirt.
I'll say, where is it? And she'll tell us.
And when she's not around, our kids sometimes can't get dressed or they don't know what they're taking to school for lunch.
It's the real daily struggle. I'll be home alone and I'll just say, dang, where is this? I need this now. I say, texting mom. Gotta text mom. And it would be to a certain point where I just spam her phone until she answers. That's how much I depend on her.
And as a viewer, I couldn't help but think I couldn't live that way.
You couldn't live that way as the wife?
Yeah, as a wife or as a mom, I don't think I could live that way.
Having all of that.
Yes, all the burden.
Responsibility. Do you see it that way when you're watching the show? Do you see it as gendered?
It wasn't until I was reading your article that it made sense to me why I was like so bothered by that. I think in the first episode, it was kind of the same thing where it's a family with two toddlers and the husband is giving his wife grief for basically that she was hiring someone out to do the laundry. And the thing is, she was like a full-time mom to running after two kids, trying to keep the household in order. He was working a lot too. And instead of kind of acknowledging that they both had a lot of burdens, he was kind of almost berating her.
We fight about laundry. And it seems silly when I say it, but really, it pisses me off, like, a lot. It's not because she doesn't do the laundry. It's because we hire somebody to come do it. It's not like I'm saying, hey, you do the laundry, you watch the kids, you do the dish. I'm saying, no, we got to do this, but let's do this as a family.
Like, hold on.
I think it was interesting because it was like... Down. Almost like asking, why did you fail me? And then I was like, why?
Well, why doesn't he do the laundry?
Right, that's exactly what I was thinking. So if he doesn't do it, then he's also the one who's hiring people.
Right.
You know, that was my first spark when I was like, oh, that wasn't spark joy. But
oh, yeah. My favorite moment in that episode is when they do this shortcut to him looking at this bed and he goes, there are seven pillows on this bed. Pause.
Those aren't even decorative pillows.
I don't know. Put the pillows away then.
Also, so you want decorative pillows? Go get a decorative pillow.
Exactly.
It seemed very odd. And I like how they left that in.
Yeah.
So how does she help negotiate that, Marie Kondo?
I don't think it's on purpose. I think it's just that four-step method she has. Han, if you recall the order.
The order is, besides just taking care of your own stuff, because they even start out in that first episode where the wife and the husband are sorting their own clothes. And at some point, she yells over at him, why are you keeping that? And then Marie was like, focus on your own
separate
stuff.
Separate piles.
And so I think that's the number one thing is there's a lot of this sort of ownership of other people's stuff and telling people what to do. And she makes you focus on your own thing. So the order that she recommends you go through is clothing, books, paper, then miscellaneous items, which goes under the word kimono.
So kitchen and garage would be those shared spaces.
Things in drawers. And then the last one is sentimental items. So supposedly this is a very specific order because it helps you learned how to intuit what that sparking joy feeling is. So when you get to sentimental items, you've honed it. So you can be a bit more decisive.
I see. But so you have to go in order.
Yeah.
Yes. And she clarifies that it's by category of item, not necessarily by room. And at first I was thinking, oh, well, wouldn't things be categorized by room? But then I remember I'm a bit, you know, into organizing already. And digging into these people's homes, I see clothing kind of shoved into every corner. And the methodology started to make more sense.
It all sounds great to wrap it all up after, what, an hour of...
Yeah.
Tidying, and all of a sudden you have a new lease on life. Your future looks bright and orderly and clean and not messy. And I mean messy in all the ways, because as you say, it reveals the messiness of these relationships as well. But what happens when Marie leaves? And do they continue their KonMari methods of living, or do things kind of revert back to how they were?
Well, I think in the book, she does talk about like backsliding and things like that. Most of the time, she says if you've really taken it all in, that you don't backslide. You love the fact that thing has its place, and so that you keep on tidying. But she does acknowledge that you might have to go through the process again and again to sort of like just create that spark joy instinct. But I would love it if the show would revisit these people. Mm-hmm. And then maybe for the next season, we'll have a where are they now and look at what they've done. I would love that.
I would also enjoy that. I also think a really interesting aspect of it is a lot of the women kept talking about the values they were teaching their children. And I think perhaps in the short term, children might be more willing to take hand in these chores that they started doing through the Marie Kondo process. And I think the other lasting image is, I feel like, at least from what I saw on the show, it was really helpful for a woman who's a widow. And the help of finally culling through the sentimental items from her deceased husband, I feel that the point of that episode was less learning the method and more tidying up as a method of moving on. And that's one that I hope the impact lasts for, not necessarily for the cleaning practices, but rather just the sense of freedom from a past life and the freedom of moving on and permission to move on.
That's interesting. I will say I remember reading the book a few years ago, and you can write this off as oh, it's just a way to organize your clothes closet and whatever. That's kind of nice for now. But when she gets into how you can take these principles and really organize the more important parts of your life, like your relationships or your career, and decide what sparks joy, then that's meaningful.
I believe so. My email inbox says that I need to apply this method to it heavily. And that would make me so much happier. And also, it is a mental burden there, too. So, yeah, I would believe it. So I need to do that.
Well, thank you both so much.
Yay.
And happy KonMari-ing. Is that how you say it?
Sure.
I think so.
Nicole Clark, culture writer for Vice, and Han Nguyen, senior editor at IndieWire. And joining us now, the newly condoized Christian Bordahl.
Hey there. No, I'm still full of clutter. I'm afraid I haven't condoized yet. Oscar nominations out today. So you talked about those earlier.
Yep.
I asked listeners about their favorite movies and performances from 2018, whether they were nominated. Lucien Coda says, my favorite Roma made it, but If Beale Street Could Talk was robbed for Best Movie Nod. Bab says, as usual, Oscar overlooks horror. She liked Hereditary, the movie so unsettling in large part due to two incredible performances from Toni Collette and Alex Wolff. I can still see the look on Alex's face in the car scene. Can't wait to see what else Ari Aster has in store for us, the director. GU says, no, Tom York should have got nominated for Best Score for Suspiria. That's that crazy, violent remake of the Dario Argento, from
crazy,
the 70s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So York wrote the movie for that remake.
Uh-huh.
He didn't get nominated for the score. He was shortlisted for the Academy Award for Best Song, which is a song I think probably a lot of KCRW listeners will recognize, called Suspirium.
This is a waltz thinking about our bodies, what they mean.
Yeah.
Typical Tom York.
Definite KCRW favorite there.
Anthony Williams said, really wish Crazy Rich Asians would have got at least a single nod somewhere, and that Into the Spider-Verse could have snuck into the Best Picture field. So... It didn't.
It didn't. Okay. Well, thank you for sneaking onto the airwaves at the end of the show, Christian Bordahl. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.